From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The year was 1981. Olivia Newton-John was getting physical, headbands and shoulder pads were fashioned forward, and Pac-Man, the old original video game sensation, was thrilling teenagers across the country. Since then, video gamers have pushed billions of dollars and hours and digital dreams into Mario, Frogger, Pokemon, and Zelda. Today, video games have never been more popular, and while the overall technology market continues to slump, the video game market is booming to the tune of more than $9 billion last year. The games aren't just about gobbling up pixel pellets anymore. Today's best video games have unnervingly realistic graphics, complex missions, and narrative depth you can wade right into, they say. Developers are finding more uses for games, from teaching the Battle of Hastings to helping out stressed business people when they need to relax. Even the Army is getting in on the action. They've developed a dramatic new video game specifically aimed at recruiting a new generation of America's soldiers from America's youth. Earlier today, I spoke with Lieutenant Colonel Casey Wardinsky, developer of the new $7.5 million Army game. He teaches at West Point. He's attending this year's Electronic Entertainment Exhibitions in Los Angeles. I asked him what a young American will find when he or she gets this game.
What they'll find is really a virtual soldier experience, and by that we mean what does it look like to be a soldier in the U.S. Army today? What do the barracks look like? What does the training look like? What does it look like when I get in trouble? What does it look like when I succeed? What does unit missions look like?
How is it like or different from other shoot 'em up bang bang games that are so popular in the video computer gaming world?
It's different in a lot of dimensions. when we began the effort, we wanted to provide a very realistic experience, but that doesn't necessarily mean you've got to have all the sort of the gore and violence that you might find in some other offerings. Instead, what we've got is a very realistic setting in which teamwork is emphasized, and you can move up through the ranks to do different jobs, and you go on into do unit missions, and you do those in a team setting, and you do them in the same manner the Army does, under rules of war, rules of engagement, and so forth. So there's a sort of guardrails on behavior, just as there are on Army personnel.
And the game has two parts. One is the let's go and handle rifles and attack or defend. The other is more about character building, I read.
Right. There are two parts. There's operations, which focuses on teams and activities within units. The other piece is called soldiers. And that one is very much a virtual role-playing game where you can see what barracks life is like. You can steer your character using values, actually, to achieve goals that are important to you. Could be getting a date, could be buying a car, or getting an education. And you can do that in all the different career fields, from avionics repair to military police to infantry.
So maybe a half a generation ago, it was the movie Top Gun that might have brought people to the military. Today, you're saying video games may be the way to do it.
Well, we think video games are a great way to at least provide information. I'm an economist, and the bottleneck from my viewpoint is the cost of information may be high if it's not interesting. And if you can put it in an interesting place, in an interesting form, people will have access to it, and then they have the information they need to make decisions about what they want to do with their life.
We read about how the U.S. military today has gone so very high-tech. Does this a younger generation that grows up with its fingers on the toggle switches of video games come to the military better prepared to deal with remote weapon systems and all the high technology weaponry of the military today?
Well, there's that impression of this quick twitch kind of skill where you're quick on buttons and so forth, but much more important is people who are comfortable with information. And as you know, these games and this sort of entertainment medium is very information dense. There's lots of visual stimulation, there's lots of sound stimulation, there's a lot of information content coming at you, and that actually is what confronts military personnel all the time. There's chaos, and from the chaos of all this information and stimulation, you have to sort out what's important. And that's where we see the real value.
Now, Casey Wardinsky, you know, of course, that there's also a generation of American parents who have raised their children in the age of video games, worried that their kids were being turned by violent movies and violent games into militaristic or violence-prone young people. What do you make of that? Are you encouraging that?
There's very little in there that anyone could see as glorification of violence. You don't achieve objectives in the game through, let's say, knocking off the enemy. You achieve them by perhaps intercepting a sale of Stinger missiles and protecting friendly forces and protecting non-combatants. And, of course, in between the objective and the beginning of the mission is the bad guys, and if they get in your way, it's very much like the U.S. Army. They'll suffer for it, but the glorification of that suffering for it is not there as you might find elsewhere.
What age range do you suggest might find this interesting?
The operations game, we've gone out to the industry standards and rated it at a teen level. So we would expect it to be played by 13-year-old folks and older. The other portion of the game, probably even younger year groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we would recommend that the age groups playing it would be.
And looking out at the rapidly, continually increasing sophistication of video games, can you imagine more in the future, more potential recruits and more troopers using video games to prepare themselves to join or function in the U.S. military?
That's what I would think. We have quite a few soldiers here who help build the game, and their reaction to it is sort of overwhelming as well, because they think it does a real good job of portraying the pride they have in their jobs and portraying the training they go through and the adventures. And our guess is that's not going to go away. And they're young folks that just came out of society, and what they find entertaining and stimulating is going to connect right up to what other folks find.
Casey Wardinsky, have you played the game?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I have. And I'm not actually a guy who spent a lot of time playing games before, but this one's actually very good. And my kids, I've got a 17-year-old and a 14-year-old, 13-year-old, and they all think it's great. They want me to go back to work every night so they can play it.
Lieutenant Colonel, have you ever been in active combat?
No, I have not. Pretty much a lot of my time has been in teaching at West Point and with the field forces over in Europe.
So the combat in the game may be some of the closest to live experience you've had yourself, even in the military.
For lots of folks in the Army, this will be a realistic portrayal of what goes on. But when you're actually on the ground doing realistic training, it's a lot more realistic, frankly. Mm-hmm. When you're tired and sweaty and the flashbangs are going off, it's not a game.
A video or computer game is still a video or computer game.
Right, correct.
Lieutenant Colonel Casey Wardinsky, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Colonel Casey Wardinsky, developer of the Army's newest recruiting tool, the video game America's Army. The video and computer game industry has grown far beyond its crude early roots. Last year, Americans spent more money on video games, hardware, and accessories than on movie tickets. And the market is expected to keep on growing with Xboxes, GameCubes, PlayStations, computer and internet games, even a new 24-hour cable station channel devoted entirely to the ins and outs of gaming. It is, you could say, a huge new world. In a box. Do video games have you glued to your joystick? Have you discovered the thrill of Grand Theft Auto 3, The Legend of Zelda, Tomb Raider, or are you shaking your head, wondering what all that beeping and flashing is about? Joining me from the E3 convention in Los Angeles is Dean Takahashi, a self-described diehard video gamer for life. Dean is senior writer for Red Herring magazine and author of Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution. Good evening, and welcome, Dean Takahashi.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us.
Mm-hmm.
Dean,
you've
been at this supersized Los Angeles convention of gamers and game creators. Some of us in listening land are diehard gamers, and others are not. Give us a picture of a snapshot of the video game industry today. It's riding pretty high, we hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. A few minutes ago, this was the noisiest place on Earth. The show's shutting down now, so it's nice and quiet again. The show itself draws 60,000 people a year, and it's pretty, you know, lively industry in the middle of all of the technology wreck that you see out there. The gamer stereotype is sort of been breaking down for years now.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, you know, envisions teenage male kid with pimples, who's not terribly social, playing games that are extremely violent, and that's a segment of the market. But the market has broadened to everybody just about.
What does the rest of the landscape look like?
Well, it's about 38% of the gamers are female, you have a wide range of genres that appeal to, you know, all sorts of folks from role-playing to puzzle games, free card games that grandmothers play on the internet, a wide spectrum of war games or whatever, strategy games that appeal to older gamers. It's sort of like whatever your thing is now, there's a game for it. And it's kind of like the movie industry in a lot of ways. It's, you know, spread out and it's fairly diverse.
What's hot at the big show there this year, E3, Electronic Entertainment? What's on people's minds?
Well, having said that, there's a lot of sequels out here, and it's just like Hollywood in the same way. The companies are very conservative. It takes a lot of money to get these games out, and so they bet on the same things over and over again. And the hottest thing I think that was at the show this year was id Software's Doom 3, which harkens back to the Doom title that came out in 1993, and when I played it, scared me out of my pants.
And what's new with Doom this year, Gene Takahashi?
Well, it just looks so much more real. The graphics are there. The sound of you snapping a cartridge into the clip of your gun. The detail of the ugly scars on the monsters that are attacking you. Mm-hmm. Beasts that are leaping out of shadows and flashing lights everywhere. It just makes you feel like you're there. You're in the middle of a nightmare, I guess. And, that sounds like your stereotypical video game, but it's just getting more and more real.
Talk to us about that curve toward reality, because I guess that's what sets video games apart, at least as they've been pursued so far. Characters move and walk and talk, and increasingly are not just that, but they're supple, and their eyelids move like your eyelids and my eyelids move. How far into that curve of realism in video games are we, and where are we headed?
Well, the big revolution in 3D graphics, started with million-dollar military simulators and moved on down to Silicon Graphics workstations that are also very, very expensive. And for the last 7 years or so, 3D graphics has been moving into the PC and into video games. And with the Xbox, with the newest NVIDIA graphics cards on the personal computer, PlayStation 2 and Nintendo's GameCube, you've got systems that are really able to spit out hundreds of times more processing power than the machines of the last generation. Like I said, it looks really real. The researchers at some places like Microsoft think that we are, say, 5 to 10 years away from machines that can really reproduce reality.
What do they mean when they say or dream of that? Reproduce reality, Dean?
Something that is really indistinguishable from looking out the window. They think that if you can put something like 80 million polygons, little geometric shapes that make up the images into one frame of a computer display, and you flash that by at 30 times a second or 60 times a second, you can get pretty darn near real. Looking like a the latest, better than the latest, Shrek movie from the animated films.
Wow! And when we get to indistinguishable from reality, what does that mean?
Well, I think once they get there, that's one goal. It's kind of like a holy grail. But once they get there, they still have to entertain people. And, looking out the window can be boring sometimes. So they still have to work on making games fun. Doing things simple is the way a lot of other game developers are going. There's a split between people who like realism and simulations of real life and people who like fantasy and cartoons.
Dean Takahashi, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're diving into all of it, the exploding world of video games. Has your passport been stamped yet in video game land? Are you a frequent flyer? What do you love about the game world? What don't you love? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The humanoid must not escape.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the exploding world of video games. Where's the bigger thrill? A great movie? Or these days, a great video or computer game? And how about the storylines today? Are these novels you can play in, movies you can move, or something else, something all new? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Dean Takahashi. He's a senior writer at Red Herring Magazine and author of Opening the Xbox. We're joined now by Douglas Perry. He's an editor at IGN, a website for video gamers. He's in charge of IGN's PlayStation 2 website. Good evening and welcome, Douglas Perry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, great. Thanks for joining us. Douglas Perry, you've got the PlayStation angle. I guess that's Sony. Talk to us about the structure and players here for a moment. There's Sony, there's Nintendo, there's Microsoft. Who's king of the mountain these days?
Well, if you're talking about market share, Sony came out in October 2000 with the PlayStation 2. The other systems, Microsoft's Xbox and Nintendo's GameCube, came out last year in November. So Sony has a year's start on everybody, and they've already shipped 30 million units worldwide and 8 million units in the United in North America alone. So while the other systems have like a million and 2 million, and they're really just starting to ramp up, Sony's already established a phenomenally huge lead in market share. In terms of the game systems themselves, a lot of them share a lot of the same strengths. They all have fantastic graphic capabilities. Mm-hmm. They all have hookups to a great sound capabilities. You can hook them with your stereo, and you can really get a great a DTS or a Dolby sound going in your room or your living room. Mm-hmm. And they all each have their own little strengths. But I would say in terms of market share, Sony's really holding court.
Now we know these PlayStations, gaming boxes, and games are like computers. There are generations. You said Sony has 8 million of PlayStation 2 out. Do you have any idea how many video computer game units are out there in total that people are using? How many households are equipped today with video or computer games? Or is it every household that has a PC?
I can say, generally, vaguely, a lot. But more specifically, if there's 8 million PlayStation 2s in North America, and that includes Canada, and they're each console has a 5-year or so lifespan. If Sony could replicate its success with the PlayStation 2, then it's going to have, I would say a third more than it had with PlayStation. So, for instance, PlayStation has 30 million installed PlayStations in North America. Mm-hmm. For the last 5 years. So, analysts forecast that the video game industry is exploding. It's always exploding, in my opinion. It's now exploding more. There's more people buying video games. So I would say that you're going to get, a third more or even, 50% more people buying video games. So in 5 years, maybe, instead of having 30 million installed units, you may have 50 million installed units. Mm.
And as Dean Takahashi has begun to point out with us, this is not just teenagers anymore, though there's an awful lot of them in the number. But there's, at this point, a couple of generations of people who have grown up with keyboards and joysticks and the discrete joys of video games. What's the profile?
Well, let's say, I'm 36, right? I started playing Pong and Asteroids and Space Invaders when I was like 7 or 8. And, the arcade games really came into America in the early 70s. And I would say that the breakdown for age groups is, there's a lot of people in my age group who played Nintendo, Super Nintendo, played in the arcades, who are still playing games and are buying systems. They have kids, their kids are buying, kids systems for the kids. The age groups are really quite large now. There's your, 8 to 12-year-old or 13-year-old age group, just 13 to, 20 or 25-year-old age group. And then, the sky's the limit, really. I think if you have a television system and you have kids or you want to do something besides watch movies, then people are really going to start, buying and playing video games. It's a social thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm, sure, of course. People sit down and play them together.
You can have, and one of the new things that's going on in video games, at least for the consoles, on the PCs, people are playing online in giant groups. They're playing with their local or networks. They're playing at work. You know, we get 15, 16, 32 people all playing together. But, you know, remember in the arcades when you go to the arcades and play against someone else?
Sure.
They're trying to bring that experience home. So you can go through a game like Half-Life or Red Faction 2, and you can play cooperatively with another player. So you can beat the whole game together. Microsoft's Xbox has a fantastic game called Halo on it, and you can play through with another person all the way to the end. And it's a fantastic social interaction.
Well, and yet hugely intermediated by all kinds of computer chips and screens. Douglas Perry, stand by. We're talking tonight about the exploding world of video games. What does it mean for a culture when its mind slips into the Xbox, the GameCube, the PlayStation? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Right as we speak, I'm playing a game called Asheron's Call. It's a what's known as an MMORPG, which stands for a massively multiplayer online role-playing game.
All right. Are you deeply engrossed, David?
I am engrossed in it, yes.
and do you play a lot?
Yeah, I do, yes.
What got you started, and why do you come back to the box?
Well, about 10 years ago, I had a disabling accident, and so I can't work anymore.
Ah.
I used to be a neurologist.
Okay.
And so I was highly trained.
Mm-hmm.
But
and accustomed to using your mind.
Yes, absolutely. And I've tried to go back to work several times in that sort of highly trained areas of medicine, but I haven't succeeded.
David, you're a neurologist. You had life circumstances left you disabled. Now you play games a lot. So we want to know how deeply gratifying is this? You're educated. You're no kid, and it sounds like you spend plenty of time at it. How good does it get?
Well, I have to say, you know, it's not the most important thing in my life. You know, the thing that really keeps me going, and that's meditation. But the game, you know, it uses up a lot of time very enjoyably.
David, thanks for your call. Thanks a lot for calling in. Dean Takahashi, how deeply into their games do people get these days? Are there people for whom this is a daily touchstone? They've got to make a little more progress on the latest game. Is it the same as someone who keeps the novel on the nightstand and has to nip in every night?
Yes, sir. There are a lot of big game addicts out there. And Asheron's Call is part of this generation of fantasy role-playing games where people go into a world and they live there and congregate. And there's another game called EverQuest from Sony that its nickname is EverCrack. And
why?
Because people spend dozens of hours a week playing the game.
Wow.
And you know,
because
it's
a constantly engrossing game that you can play differently each time you go into it.
Douglas Perry, you've read novels, you've seen movies, you've played the games. What's the unique quality or texture of video game playing? Does it have the same significance? Can it bring the same kind of epiphanies? Can it bring the same kind of emotional catharsis or insight on the world that these older forms of entertainment and enlightenment have?
That's a really good question. And I think that you know, David, our caller, our previous caller, was mentioning, you know, role playing game, which are, you know, back when they were all based on Dungeons and Dragons, which is a role playing game. So you're taking on a role, and you're fulfilling this character. And I think human beings have the capacity for large imagination, and they want to have different experiences, and they want to try different things. So unlike a book where you're sitting there and you're reading, you know, black lines on white paper. Where you're using an imagination or versus the television where you're sort of sitting there passively, you're able to control these games, these game environments. You're able to launch yourself into this imaginative world and play a character. And I think on the one hand, there's some really fantastic story-based games like Onimusha 2, like the one that was just mentioned, lots of role-playing games like Final Fantasy, where you're deeply engrossed in a character, and it's a very unique experience that is very satisfying if it's a good story, you know, and it allows you to vent your frustrations as well, and a lot of times when there's a good story, you know, you feel really close to the characters and you want to be close to them again the next time in the game. You know, hopefully when there's a sequel.
I can't speak to it myself, but I can attest to having seen people come out of Days and Days on a game in a kind of elevated state of total engrossment and narrative engrossment that really astonished me. But still, you were talking about books as lines on paper. Those lines have been, you know, doorways of perception, doorways to realms of imagination. Is there a place for imagination in a video game?
Absolutely. What you can do with a lot of games is you can they're set. They're sort of concrete code that's already been made. But a lot of games now are enabling you to customize your characters, to grow your characters, to customize your car. So you can have a car that looks differently than someone else's. So that, you know, yes, it's been coded for you. Yes, it's sort of a finite thing. But as we move online, and you're able to customize your characters and your cars or your helicopters or whatever kind of game you're playing, there is a great potential for the imagination.
That's right, David. That's right.
Dean Takahashi.
They have more freedom of movement in games now. You can basically, see that, you know, you have to achieve this goal in the game, but the way you do it and the path you get there can be different every time.
But Dean Takahashi, though, stack it up for us. The best, most moving read you ever had and the best video game you ever played, which made a bigger impact on your thinking, your life, your sense of the world we live in?
Well, I got into writing because I love to read, and the first set of books that really set me on fire was The Lord of the Rings, back in seventh grade or so.
Now a video game.
Yeah, and when the movie came out last year, and, it took 25 years for them to really turn that into something, truly great cinema. And they're on the cusp of trying to turn the series into a bunch of video games now.
Yeah. So do you think for a 12-year-old or today, who what would you suggest? Dive into the book or dive into the video game? Where's the greater human intellectual payout?
I get a great kick out of crossing back and forth between media. And so, you know, I love to go see the movie, to read the book, and to play the game. Maybe hear the music in the as well.
we're going to have it all.
If you don't mind me interrupting, I would like to add that I think there's room in our world and for in the world for us to all to have books, to have movies, and to have video games on equal levels. You know, when I get done with a 300-page novel, I feel phenomenally satisfied in a way that I wouldn't if I'd finished a 20-hour game. But I also have a fantastic sense of revelation when I finish a great game.
Mm-hmm.
You sit around, you talk with your friends about it, you want to rethink it, and a game like Deus Ex for the PC and on the PS2, that game was full of customization, full of ways that you can play it over and over and over again with a lot of good text in it, a lot of good writing, and a really good storyline.
And you, in the moment. Douglas Perry, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Douglas Perry is editor at IGN, a website for video gamers. We're talking about the exploding world of video games. What's the most fun you ever had with a video joystick? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Good to talk to you again. I wanted to talk about sort of the culture. I'm 27.
Okay.
I've been playing video games about 20 plus years. The old games, though.
You're a lifer, Mike.
I'm totally a lifer. I started with the Coleco Pong, Telestar games way back when, I've kind of grown along with the video game culture. But
yes, you have.
What I want to say is that the nostalgia for the classic games. I mean, there are still classic games that are 8-bit, pixelated, square, blocky things that move back and forth. I mean, we still love those games, and there's a kind of a growing culture now of emulators and what they call ROMs. Essentially, you take and you create a arcade game emulator, which runs the ROMs from the old cartridges. You collect the old cartridges, you burn them you extract the software from them, essentially, and then run the emulator on another console.
So the video game past is always with us, like Casablanca at the art cinema.
Exactly, and one of the most prominent examples of this right now is the Sega Dreamcast as a game console. It's kind of failed in the sense that Sega's no longer making a console, but the Dreamcast is almost the ultimate achievement because it's a platform that lets you run almost any kind of emulator. You could actually run it as a PlayStation. You can run it as a Nintendo Entertainment System from the original Nintendo. There are people my age that are writing software to run the old games on the new platform.
And Mike, when you go back and play Pong or Mario, are you 7 years old again? Does it take you back that way? What's the thrill?
It absolutely does. I mean, the music. I mean, the tinny sounds, the blocky graphics. It's all totally a trip down memory lane.
So, Mike, I'm just curious because you really are the sort of coexistent with the video game era. What was your parents' attitude to the game? Did they happily plant you in front of it? Did they keep you away from it? Was it free range?
You know, I think it was a mixture of both. I was always kind of introverted as a kid, so I spent a lot of time behind books. So they were always telling me to go outside anyway. But I mean, we had the Atari 2600, we had a Commodore 64. I mean, we went all the way up the chain for game systems, and you know, it wasn't so much it was pretty hands off in general, I think.
There you go,
you
know, Mike, you've seen it all. Thanks for calling in and sharing it with us. I want to welcome Charles Hirshhorn right now. He's CEO of G4 Media. It's a new 24-hour, 7-day-a-week cable television network devoted entirely to video games. He was former president of Walt Disney Television. Good evening and welcome, Douglas. Charles Hirshhorn.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So you've jumped from television to video games. Why?
Well, I think I'm still in the television business because G4 is a television network, but the subject matter has changed from Disney family programming to video games.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I should say, but from sort of the traditional themes of TV to covering the video game world.
Well, one of the things that you've been alluding to is, you know, the graphic quality of games and how they've evolved. And having been in the entertainment business for the last 20 years, it's just been remarkable. If anybody had, asked me in 1994 if a computer program would make compelling theatrical entertainment, I wouldn't have believed that Toy Story the next year would make people laugh and cry and, you know, all be based on a computer program. And I think now, especially with this new generation of consoles, the graphic quality of the games themselves make very compelling television.
Charles Hirshhorn, stand by. We've got to take a short break, and Dean Takahashi will be right back. We're talking about the exploding world of video games. What does it mean for a culture when its mind slips into the Xbox, the GameCube, the PlayStation? And where does this all end? Will we live in video games? Do we already? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the exploding world and culture of video games tonight. Where's the bigger thrill, a great movie or a great game? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. My guests are Dean Takahashi. He's author of Opening the Xbox. And Charles Hirshhorn. He's CEO of G4 Media. It's a new 24-hour, 7-day-a-week cable television network devoted entirely to video games. Charles Hirshhorn, I'm looking at a news story here about a bill introduced in Congress this month that would make it a federal crime to sell or rent violent video games to minors. That, of course, includes a lot of teenagers. And it says it would apply to games that feature decapitation, amputation, killing of humans with lethal weapons, or through hand-to-hand combat, rape, carjackings, aggravated assault, and other violent felonies. And the story points out that if this is passed, and it's got a fair amount of support, an awful lot of video games that are at the top of the popularity list right now would be taken out of the hands of their most voracious market. A, do you think this bill will pass? And B, what about what we see on an awful lot of these games, which is a fair amount of gore and destruction?
Well, I think that it's undeniable that there's a lot of gore and violence and antisocial behavior in games. I do think it's sort of the vocal minority. I think the vast majority of games are much more productive and constructive of that.
Well, so you say, but I have to say, having walked by a number of, you know, a lot of boxes in my lifetime, boy, you know, it is not at all hard to find the heads popping off and the blood squirting out.
Well, I agree. And having said that, you know, I think everyone has an obligation of responsibility, both as retailers, as game developers, as game publishers, as a television network. You know, I think these games, the industry has taken on it themselves to have a good rating system. I think they should expect the retailers to live by the ratings and, you know, not sell games.
But is there something? Is there something in the medium itself, in how visceral it can be, and increasingly realistic, as Dean Takahashi has pointed out, that makes gore and mayhem the kind of natural feast for video games?
I think it's in the culture. I don't think it's in the medium. I think you know, if you're under 16, you want to know what it's like to drive a car. If you don't own a gun, you want to know what it's like to shoot it. It's always, you know, it's been true when children, as Westerns were popular and video games became popular. I think they're all fantasy elements.
Nick is on the line. Welcome, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I find myself kind of in an interesting situation because I'm a preschool teacher.
Okay.
And I'm trying in my class to instill positive values and community building. And in our classroom, we don't allow any play that involves weapons or guns. And recently, I got really into playing Grand Theft Auto 3.
Describe that for us, Nick.
Well, it's a pretty, I mean, it goes along with a lot of things that you were just saying about it has involves carjacking and murder and, you know, all these horrible things that, you know, myself as a teacher, I'm trying to shield my children from.
So preschool teacher by day and video game murderer and carjacker by night. Teacher Nick.
That pretty much summed it up. And it was, I find it really, you know, there's a part of, there's a part of everybody that needs some sort of way of venting, and playing out certain fantasies and things. And I think that many ways in preschool, you can see children who have issues of control and fear.
But bottom line, is this letting off steam or is this building appetites?
Well,
Nick?
And that's the thing that I don't know. And I think that's the eternal question about it, is that on some levels, I'm sure that people can sort of get a release of a lot of sort of negative things by living them out in a fantasy life. But for some people who don't have a clear distinction between what is fantasy and what's reality, I think it really can be harmful.
Instill that moral compass, Nick, and thanks for calling. Dean Takahashi, what about it? Are we always going to see the video game realm as a realm that seems to celebrate the really gaudy, bloody, gory side of life, stuff we can't easily do in the real world but are welcomed to do in the video world?
I think it's the parallels to Hollywood are very good here, where you see the top box office hits are so predictable, and you know, they're of the sort of the,
you mean,
know,
Harry Potter
action movies, you know, that resort to violence or that, you know, you know, play out a tried and true formula for the audiences that they know are going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still some risk takers in Hollywood who make independent films, you know, things like A Beautiful Mind, where, you know, you get some surprises and some stories that are, you know, really, really, you know, move you or surprise you. And there's the same thing that goes on in the video game industry. Today I was looking at a game called Project Ego by a developer named Peter Molyneux, and it's a role-playing game where you start out at 15 years old and you age through the game, and you can play it all the way through till you're like 60 years old in the game.
and I guess you can age while you're actually playing it as well. Dean Takahashi, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Dean Takahashi is senior writer for Red Herring Magazine and author of Opening the Xbox: Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution. And Charles Hirshhorn, thank you so much for being with us. Last question, 10 seconds. When will video games bury movies? Will it ever happen?
I think they'll coexist. I do think video games will be bigger than the movie industry in the next 5 years.
There you go. We'll remember the prediction. Charles Hirshhorn, CEO of G4 Media, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on our forums. In a moment, letters home from World War II written in the grooves of a 78. This is On Point. On Point's audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up songs and sounds from the last century for our program. Tonight, as we begin the Memorial Day weekend, he shares a story of discovery and the voices of sailors and soldiers in another war and another time.
Hello, Mom and Pop, Irene, Bobby, how are you?
About 15 years ago, while poking around in a box at a second-hand store, I found an odd-looking 78 RPM record. It was made of flexible cardboard with a plastic coating, and it was stuffed in a mailing envelope, addressed to a family near Boston. The cancel stamp said 1943. Later that night, I took it out of the envelope and played it. A young sailor's voice filled the room. It was a talking letter to his family.
I guess you're pretty surprised to get this, but we were up here at the USO and we saw the sign about having records made, so I thought we'd all run up here and get it. We're up here for the weekend in Seattle. There's about five of us. We've been having a very good time, going to dances and going out to the campus.
It was a strange experience. These words were intended for his family, not for me. I listened on and felt a chill. It hit me that this kid may have never made it home. These words may have been the last ones his family ever heard.
It seems like we're on the other side of the world, way out here in Washington. It's pretty nice, except the sun never shines. And how's everything at home?
I was curious as to how this and other amateur recordings from World War II came to be made. In the late 1930s, just as Europe entered the war, few American companies began producing inexpensive tabletop phonographs with home recording units built in. You could cut your own records. When the war began, these machines were pressed into service for the morale effort. In 1941, Jem Razorblades and the Packard Bell Company started sending roving recorders out to military bases where GIs often queued up in all-night recording sessions to send a reassuring word home before shipping out. By mid-1942, the USO and Pepsi-Cola had set up canteens where GIs could get a hot cup of coffee, a shave, and make a record to mail home. The Red Cross provided blank discs and recording machines to military hospitals throughout the country. Millions of these records were made during the war years. There aren't many left. The records are often unlabeled and long separated from their mailing envelopes. No date, no location, no idea who made them. Over the years, these 78s were discarded, tucked away in drawers, mixed in with commercial recordings, and forgotten. But once in a while, they turn up at flea markets or yard sales, mixed in with commercial records. Most of them are solo, a cappella renditions of popular songs of the day. Here's a group of GIs singing their version of Glenn Miller's 1941 hit, Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Get your dinner on the dinner, now it's a good fire. Fast you have your ham and eggs and Carolina. When you hear the whistle blow and they do the bar, then you know the Tennessee is not very far.
Nurses and canteen volunteers often joined in songs with guys that only met a few minutes earlier. Sometimes they sang solos to families they didn't even know.
One of the girls here we're with is going to sing Embrace While You for me, and we've got another fellow here who used to work in a broadcasting company. He's going to introduce her. So don't forget to save these records when I get home so I can listen to them myself.
This program is transcribed from a preceding broadcast of the Columbia Broadcasting System. We now present Esther Hazen singing Embraceable You. Esther?
Mm-hmm. Embrace me, my sweet embraceable you. Embrace me.
If it weren't for the war, many GIs would have married their high school sweethearts and never left their hometowns. In this 1943 record, labeled to Jeanette from Ray, you can hear her broken heart.
All I can do is say that I love you and I ever will until I die. I wish I was back home with you and I wish to stay with you. I wish I could hold you in my arms and kiss you again once more like we used to and make love to you like we used to and go places like we used to. And I'm starting to hate the Navy now.
Our enemies also use the new portable recording technology in their battle for hearts and minds. As part of its propaganda effort, the Japanese government brought recorders into the prison camps and recorded scripted messages from Allied prisoners. They then beamed them over shortwave to the Pacific coast. In June 1944, someone in California caught this broadcast and re-recorded it. Here's Radio Man First Class Otis Musselwhite, U.S. Navy, captured in Guam, sending a shortwave message from a Japanese prison camp to his mother in Cordelia, Georgia.
I'm in good health and my weight is normal. I've received some mail, Red Cross food, for which I am very grateful. I wish especially to say hello to Miss Marie Wallace of 110 Magnolia Avenue, Millbrae, California. Marie, please notify my mother and father of this broadcast and tell them I am fine and they have nothing to worry about. Also, please tell Mrs. Dorothy...
Sometimes we're lucky enough to find out a little background on a recording. Private Joe Petrucci served with the 83rd Infantry and sent records home to his family in Providence, Rhode Island. Joe landed at Normandy in 1944 and fought his way across France and Germany. He's got a photo of himself sitting in the office at Hitler's Eagle's Nest compound. Here's Private Petrucci singing Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Now there's one more to go, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show, what a prayer.
I think my favorite wartime home recording is one made by a young man from East Providence, Rhode Island, who wrote and sang, I'm hanging my saddle on the old ranch house door. It's about a cowboy leaving behind his buddies and his horse to fight Hitler. These records don't offer much for military historians. Mentions of the big issues, troop movements, or destination was prohibited. What they do offer is a very human, heartwarming look at a country at war and the hopeful, youthful voices of a heroic generation now passing from the American scene.
Hello, Mom and Dad. This is me again.
I'll leave you with a soldier recuperating in Ward 17 at the Camp Edwards Military Hospital singing, I Wish I Knew. I wish we knew how to thank them all.
I wish I knew someone like you could love me. I wish I knew you place no one above me. Did I mistake this for a romance?
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. To read more about talking letters, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Why let me hope and pray so? Don't lead me on. If I'm a fool, just say so. Should I keep dreaming on? Or just forget?
From Boston University, this is WB.